You tune into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
All right, the shoes are coming off here at fullserviceradio.org, broadcasting from the Line Hotel. I am joined by kind of combination national treasure and everyone's favorite Jewish grandma, Joan Nathan. I'm really thrilled to have you here at Origins. Thanks for joining us.
And what about friend?
And friend. I'm really lucky to call you my friend as well. And one of my first friends here in D.C.
Right, absolutely. So
thrilled to talk to you about what's been going on with you, especially this book. King Solomon's Table, which is just a let's cut right to the chase, and maybe the quickest thing would be what awards hasn't this won?
Oh, well, it did not get a James Beard Award.
No,
it didn't.
That seems.
I know, but yeah. It didn't.
Go figure.
But it but it's done very well.
It's a spectacular book, and I'd like to talk about this book in a minute. But let's go back a little bit. I was recently watching some of your earlier work, and you have this incredible career. And at a certain point, you made a series of PBS cooking shows called
Jewish Cooking in America.
Jewish
with
Cooking
Joan
in America.
Nathan.
And with who?
With Joan Nathan.
Right. And and it turns out it was with a lot of other people too, which it's fascinating to watch. It's incredibly entertaining, and like most of your work that I've encountered, it's also very informative. I saw you cooking with Jean-Louis Paladin. I saw you shopping and kind of filling Julia Child in on what kosher means. I saw you baking bagels with Nancy Silverton. It's really something else. And it's such a tremendous, document. A lot of these folks are no longer with us.
Right.
And so I think it's tremendous to go back and see it. But it also reminded me that your work, a lot of it is informed by some of the best culinary talents of generations, past and present. But so let's go back and talk a little bit how you got started on this path.
Well, I was working in Jerusalem for the mayor of Jerusalem, then mayor, called Teddy Kollek. And this was in the early 70s. I was in my 20s. And I was his foreign press attaché. So my job was to learn about Jerusalem. And the mayor of Jerusalem, who was quite a character, loved to eat. And I learned through him that when you sit down with people, you break a lot of barriers, a lot of human barriers.
Sit down to eat, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You become... And... we would go to Christian, Jewish, and Muslim homes, Orthodox Jews, radical Jews, all kinds. And just by saying, I like your food, and sitting with people, the mood totally changed. And once we were in a Palestinian village outside Jerusalem, and we wanted the people in that village, this was in 1970, they wanted a road. And the mayor knew that it would be difficult to give them the road, that they had one nearby. But, another village nearby had gotten a road, but didn't need as long a road, and it would be very expensive. So we went to visit them, and thinking we weren't going to give them the road because we just couldn't. And we sat down, and they first gave us some, coffee. And then a bit later, they had this, my favorite dish in the world, which is called musakhan. And it's a chicken on a big, huge pita with lots of olive oil and sauteed onions, lots of them, with sumac and a little bit of cloves and a little bit of cinnamon, tiny bit of cinnamon. And we ate it. You eat it with your hands, your right hand, of course. And it was just dripping with olive oil, and it's a fabulous dish.
And you're eating the bread with it?
We're eating the bread with it, and we're telling them how much we love it. And then by the end of the meal, they got their road. He made friends, and everything changed. And I've seen it over and over again. I mean, he was kind of brilliant because he had a municipal council of 32 people that no one agreed on anything. And he was able to crack jokes. He just was able to break those barriers too, not necessarily by food, but also jokes are great for that. In families, I would say.
But food across all kinds of lines.
So I got this idea from the mayor that maybe I should write a cookbook, which I did, called The Flavor of Jerusalem. It was my first cookbook. And it came out in 1975. And I interviewed all these people from the different communities of Jerusalem. And when Otto Lenghi was writing his Jerusalem cookbook, he didn't know me at the time. And he talked about these people. And the next thing I knew, that he referenced my book. It was the only book that he referenced before he wrote Jerusalem. So he had clearly used it as a guide.
Really cool. And so now we come up through... How did you end up in D.C.?
Well, my husband and I had gotten married in 1974. We moved to Boston. And then he got his Ph.D. and decided he would work at the Justice Department. So he got a job in the Justice Department. And I had been working at the time. I'd been at the Kennedy School for a year, which was wonderful, at Harvard. And then I started writing for the Boston Globe. And then when my husband got this job at the Justice Department, the food editor, whose name was Gail Perrin, wrote to Marion Burroughs, remember her, and Bill Rice, and said that I was coming to Washington and that they should hire me. So I went to see them, and they immediately wanted me to write a column. And I was pregnant at the time, and I was, in those days, old, right? I was like 30, let me think, I got married, about 34.
You were what?
I was old, 34, for a baby. All my friends got married when they were 20, 22, right after college, right? Anyway, so I was scared. I probably listened to my mother in the back of my mind, because my mother, all she really wanted me to do was to get married. And I thought, I don't know if I would want the pressure of every day, every week column. And so I said, no, could I write when I wanted to? And they said, yes. So I wrote about sort of quirky ethnicity and food things in the Washington area, which is something I love to do.
And when was this that you got here? You were 34, old, obviously.
I was old, 1977, because my first child was born that year. And I started writing for the Globe, and it was fun, you know. And I did that for about 10 years. And then the Washington Post had a magazine editor that really didn't want food in the magazine anymore. And I was writing at that time in the magazine every other week or something like that. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to try to see if I can start writing for the New York Times. And I was able to, so.
Wow. And when cookbooks followed, obviously, and it's kind of become your Jewish cooking is kind of the reference, right?
Well, it's fun. You know, I was just rereading something that I had written in the 70s. It was probably in the Washington Post. I was, when I first came to Washington, besides writing for the Post, I started working for the Smithsonian and the Folklife Festival as a consultant. And I had to go to a Vietnamese community in Bowie, Maryland, for a little booklet, because they were going to be the food that was featured, and the cooks for the, you know, for the recipes at the Folklife Festival of the it was 1979's Folklife Festival, and this woman was one of the first boat people that came to Washington, and her name was Mrs. Fong, and she and her husband were great cooks, and she was a great Vietnamese gardener right in Bowie. And so I spent several days, probably weeks, watching her cook everything and meeting her relatives, and then transferring that transcribing it for the Folklife Festival. And it was really good. I read it last week, and I just loved it. So, you know, that was the kind of thing I did. And I always wanted to be an anthropologist, and I guess in a way that's what I am, as an anthropologist.
Do you feel a responsibility in doing this work? In, we were just talking about this, actually, kind of this, the history and the documentation and preserving something. What is your responsibility to authenticity in these traditions?
Huh. Well, actually, I think that my real responsibility is the authenticity. I feel as, you know, somebody once called me the Indiana Jones. Of course, I didn't even know who Indiana Jones was when they called me that, of Jewish food. And now that I've seen Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, I think I am. I mean, I get so excited about a recipe that I've never heard of that I zero in on it right away. And I feel as if, because of the Holocaust, so many recipes were lost in Eastern Europe. And one of them, it's called a Schritzlach. It's a blueberry bun. It's in my King Solomon's Table. I only learned after I wrote the book that everybody, Jews and Gentiles, were both eating these delicious buns, you know, filled with fresh blueberries. And you should serve them here, actually. they're just delicious. Anyway, but the Jews called them one thing, and the Gentiles, and people, you know, just the way today, people live their own lives in their own communities. But in those days, they didn't have the internet. They didn't have anything. So you didn't really know what other people were doing. They called them blueberries. I think it's called jagodis or something like that in Polish, and it's called something similar in Yiddish. And then there's this weird name, Schritzlach, which means basically currant cakes. But I guess you use blueberries in the spring. And I discovered them in Toronto. I wasn't in Toronto, but somebody told me about them. And then I started looking and learning everything about these recipes, including the recipe. And I realized after I discovered this recipe that this would have been something gone if a few immigrants hadn't come the turn of the century to Toronto and worked in a bakery and made it, so that all these other immigrants from Poland learned about something that they lost. And like borscht, which Polish Jews and Gentiles all ate borscht, but because of vaudeville, because of the Jews that brought this recipe to their bakeries, it became emblematic of a Jewish dish. But it wasn't at all. And I didn't know that when I was writing this book. It was actually a cameraman on one of my interviews who said, "Oh yeah, I know that." It's like, and he told me exactly what it was. It wasn't necessarily a breakfast bun. It was very often a dinner bun that filled with these wonderful blueberries and served with whipped cream in other communities. But in the Jewish community, it was always for breakfast.
And so you have these entire cultures almost preserved.
Right.
In a recipe.
Cultures in a recipe. Absolutely.
So then there is a real responsibility, because if you get it wrong, you're...
Well, also, let me just tell you, because when the Nazis came into Poland, in the southwest Poland, there were a lot of religious Jews, which meant they wore the clothing of a religious Jew. So as soon as the Nazis came in, they couldn't hide. They were taken away to Auschwitz immediately. So recipes and culture and music and all kinds of things in some villages were, you know, just wiped out. So that's where I feel a responsibility for good recipes, not the bad ones, you know, to bring them for a next generation. That's really what I love doing. And I get fired up, honestly, every time I find something. And I've been doing this for, what, 40 years?
And well, the passion is still abundantly clear, and maybe never more so than in the book King Solomon's Table, which I have in front of me. And I've opened it to one of my favorite recipes, and I want to talk to you about this maybe as a way of talking about the book and what you've achieved here. And I guess I'll start by saying that it's incredible, and it's been very useful to me, I think, to understand tradition and culinary traditions and recipes, and for me, the foodways of the Chesapeake are really important. But
maybe obviously, that's why we're such good friends. Okay, but go on.
But obviously, culinary traditions are still living things as well. I mean, they are here with us, and if they're still alive, they're evolving. And I think this book does an incredible job of kind of blending the two, which is one of the reasons I want to ask you about green chili relleno latkes.
Oh, well, that's a good one. Tom and Joanne Ash are two of my favorite people, and they live in Placidas, I think it's called, New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And actually, they're the in-laws of Seth Meyers, you know who he is.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, so they love to cook.
Insert joke here. I got nothing. But yeah, go
ahead.
Anyway,
they love to cook, and they love to cook with their family. And they always have a lot of people around. And I know them from Martha's Vineyard, but I've also visited them in New Mexico. So they love to make potato pancakes. And so their nephew had a project. I forget exactly what it was, but it was something about New Mexico. And he got this idea of taking a pepper, chili pepper, and embedding it in a potato pancake, and then serving it with either sour cream or applesauce, and it's really good, you know. And it's just another way of adapting food to where you live,
which we'll talk about in a second, but. Especially adapting into this place. But I want to point out just the deep kind of technique that's in this relatively simple recipe. And this is one of the reasons, I mean, there are probably a zillion latke recipes out there published and on the internet, God only knows how many. But starting with the onion, you say here in this recipe, alternately grate some of the onion in a food processor fitted with a steel blade, blah, blah, blah. Or in the large holes of a large box grater, some of the potatoes on the smallest. Doing it in this order will keep the potato mixture from blackening.
Right.
Where does that come from? I have never seen that, and that's genius.
Well, it's I guess it's from, I don't know, I must have learned it from my mother-in-law.
Wow. And then, just continuing, you squeeze the potato and onion mixture out, which I've seen. But I've never seen anyone talk about the potato starch that you retain.
Oh, yeah, you retain it. But you know something? You can just take potato starch.
No, but this is so much cooler.
I know, and you just whole, and it sort of comes to the bottom.
Yeah.
And then you just put it in.
Right.
But I sometimes think, what am I doing this for? Just, you know, take a box of potato starch or arrowroot or something.
Well, don't do that. Do this, because this is really cool. And of course, you know, food waste is a big subject right now.
Right.
So maybe you're a little bit ahead of you are very much ahead of your time. it is also interesting the way that place and these traditions come together. And obviously, a lot of the traditions that you document didn't really start here.
Right.
They've taken root here. One of my favorite episodes of Jewish cooking in America was the bagel episode. You did with Nancy.
Uh-huh.
And do you remember the name of the guy that came in?
I thought his name was Cohen, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't think he's alive anymore.
He was incredible. Well, yeah. I think he was 80 when you did
right, and we
the
did
episode.
That was, right,
was, and that was 20 years ago.
Yeah. So I forget his name, but if you had told me, I would have found it.
It's great. I recommend anybody go find that on YouTube and watch it. You'll learn something. And I also just want to say, apropos of nothing, I had a Bialy for breakfast this morning.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So.
Where? Here?
In New York.
Oh, you were in New York?
I started out the day in New York, and now I'm...
Where did you get it in New York?
Zaro's. It was...
Oh, that wasn't a great...
It was not a great... Okay, but kind of trying to get in the right frame of mind.
Okay.
But here we are talking about these traditions, and we're here in Washington, D.C.
Right.
You asked me earlier about my Amish farming buddy,
right.
Omer Beiler, who grows a lot of, among many other things, wheat for us.
Uh-huh.
And we have a bagel here. That we bake in the hotel. I wanted you to try it. So this is a bagel.
Yeah.
That Amanda, one of our bakers here, has created, and we top it with benne seed instead of sesame seed.
Oh.
Which we can also get from reliably from our friend Glenn Roberts, and then we use traditional technique, but we use Omer's flour. And I wanted to see what you thought of this.
Oh, my goodness. Really?
Yeah.
Has he ever had a bagel?
I don't think he's had it. That's a great... We should take a couple up next time we go see him.
Mm. These are delicious. I love the benne topping.
Oh. Interesting the way that those two, the bagel making tradition and...
You know, it's a little bit. It's like a tahina topping.
It has that little... Uh-huh. That edge to it, mm-hmm. That little bitterness. Now we're going to have our mouths full of bagels, and it's probably a perfect time to ask you about Baltimore. I'm asking you about Baltimore because that's kind of my home base, but it's also a city with tremendous Jewish tradition. And
a lot of just ethnic. I love Baltimore because it's such an ethnic city, and there's still quarters that are just don't change, like Providence.
Mm-hmm.
People want to live there because... Their families have lived there for generations. They might not be able to change the way other people want to change, but and there are those wonderful houses.
Anything about the Jewish culinary traditions in Baltimore that stand out to you?
Mm. Well, they're mostly Eastern European and German. That now there are a lot of Russians, actually. Mm. I love the benne. We have to go visit those Amish together.
We should.
Absolutely. It's known for corned beef roe, so that's a big thing. And Jewish traditions have just stayed one generation after the other. So a lot of these traditions are really just part of who they are in Baltimore. And like I come from Providence, which is a very similar town to Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these families know each other for generations and serve the same recipes over and over and over again from one generation to the next. So that it's a town that for sure has horseradish, great horseradish, has a lot of gefilte fish, has a lot of corned beef. And
we still have the Tulkoff's factory.
Yeah,
in,
exactly.
With the horseradish. I went there. It's an eye-watering tour, to put it mildly.
Well, I actually harvested my horseradish this morning, and I made my own horseradish sauce.
How is it this year? Has the rain affected?
No, well, mine, I think it was pretty good. I have to just keep it for about a week, and then I can really tell. But I learned from somebody from the Gold family about how to make horseradish. I don't know who owns Tolkoff, if Tolkoff owns Gold or Gold.
Who knows in this day of consolidation, but they still seem pretty independent to me.
But what I learned is that the more you grind it, the sharper it'll be.
You know what I do? I use ice. Did you ever try that?
No.
Grind it with ice.
Oh, what a good idea.
That's how we've been doing it at Woodbury for years.
And why? Oh, because it makes it cold.
Yeah.
And that has to be cold, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. Can I steal that idea?
Of course. I doubt it originated with me. But
when do they make their horseradish sauce?
They make it this time of year at Tolkoff's.
It's at your restaurant.
We make it too. You know, whenever we start getting horseradish, it comes in kind of over the course of this time of year, over a month or so. And we have a couple. You know, most farmers want to stay away from it because it establishes itself and it becomes this. It's not invasive per se, but
it is pretty invasive.
But it establishes itself and it spreads. And if you ever want to get rid of it, it's a whole deal.
And deer don't even like to eat it.
Right. And the leaves are, you know, not of much interest to animals either. So
right.
So I love having it though. I love having piquant flavors in our repertoire, and horseradish is a great source of that.
I want to ask you something. Do you ever use the leaf for anything?
I haven't found a use. You know, we had this guy that was growing wasabi for us, and he was trying to sell us wasabi leaf, and I just didn't find it that palatable. But maybe you can always dig deeper. I haven't found a use for it yet. So, have you had the Atman's corned beef lately?
No, I haven't been there in a long, but I used to always go there.
So that is still kind of, you mentioned Corned Beef Row in Baltimore, and it's, you know, like a lot of things, it's probably not what it was. I can say that it isn't what it was in its heyday, but it's, Atman's is still, I would say, it's good. It might not be as good as the corned beef you made with Jean-Louis on your show, but.
Well, you know something, it's so fascinating to me that restaurants like Atman's now, it's not necessarily the Jewish people that are going there, but lots of people that really want to eat well, so they're, or a lot at lunch, will go there. So you'll get a lot of contractors that'll go there. You'll get a lot of other ethnic communities that like meat.
Yeah.
And it's changing. Because corned beef is corned beef, and so maybe you'll eat it once or twice a year.
But yeah, but it's jammed at lunch. I mean, that's one thing that I'm happy to report is that it's still.
Maybe I'll go there.
Come up and see us in Baltimore. We'll go for lunch. I want to talk to you now about, as someone who's thought so much about these things and worked and written so much about it, about this kind of intersection of cuisine and religion. And it seems that the two serve each other in a way, in that, you know, having a cuisine that's still relevant and valued helps. I need to understand this because I don't feel like I do have a handle on it, but then it's also the cuisine is also kind of preserved in a way by the fact that it's part of a religious tradition. Is there something to that, or can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, when I think of Jewish food, I think of three things. And in a way, you said it really well. The first I think of is the dietary laws. And no, there's no question in my mind that that's what makes Jewish food Jewish. Even if you don't do it, in the back of your mind, you realize there's this connection between Mount Sinai and, you know, and the laws of Leviticus and Judaism and the Jews.
But who knew that connection went through Pittsburgh?
Right. Or Baltimore.
Right.
And it's more than just dietary laws. After you go to services, you have a meal. Passover Seder is a meal. So first of all, there's a lot of, if you're religious and if you're Orthodox or you follow the dietary laws, there's a certain discipline that, you know, it's like you can't eat certain things.
Well, these are rules.
These are rules, right. But the other thing is that when they're around a table, you bring out the traditional foods. That's when you do it, when you're with your family. And so somebody once said that sort of the Sabbath bound the Jews, but the Jews bound the Sabbath. And in a way, that's true, because if you, like, we're not particularly religious, but every Friday night we have a Shabbat dinner. And I always make challah and have some traditional recipes, but I like to cook seasonally, and I'm always testing. So I'm testing, it might be a Kurdish Kuba soup, which are the big, heavy dumplings with meat inside, in an Aramaic, something that goes way back to the Bible, or an Eastern European matzo ball soup. But that's my family. But each family has different foods that they serve either for the holidays or for Shabbat that says, this is my family. And I feel that in the world we live in today, where everything is different, but everything's the same, if you know what I'm saying. I think people are craving differentiation, but they're also craving the comfort of being together. So that's the first thing I think of is with Jewish food. The second is that Jews are obsessed about food, not only because of the laws, but because they were winemakers. I mean, now they're winemakers, but they were wine distributors. They were grain distributors since Joseph in the Bible. There's so many Jewish food writers. I don't know if you've realized that. Mimi Sheraton, Marion Burroughs, I don't know, just lots of them all over the country. Jonathan Gold was Jewish. Uh-huh. Tony Bourdain's mother was Jewish. You know, so because we're interested in it, it's really not just Jewish food, but food. It's obsession. The third thing I think about when I think about Jewish food is the fact that we were kicked out of so many countries that we went to other places and had to adapt. Just like in New Mexico, they adapted their potato latkes with the chilies. But for example, I was in El Salvador for my cookbook, for that book, and there was a woman who made yucca latkes instead of potato latkes with cilantro cream, because potatoes don't really grow in hot, hot climates.
Right.
And so this was the adaptation, but because of the dietary laws and the holidays, there were reasons that you wanted to, you know, to have these recipes again and again. And I think it's comforting to do that. And that's, you know, that to me is what the whole shtick of Jewish food is. And I'll just say one other thing. I know I've talked too much.
No.
But a long time ago, Lynn Rosetta Casper was talking to me about Italian food. And she said, you know, Italian food is rooted in one land. And I realized, wait a minute, that's the difference. Jewish food, even though it goes back to ancient Israel, is rooted in the laws, not in one land.
And that it's interpreted and it's still, I mean, within those laws, within the framework of those rules, it becomes a latke
with chili.
With chilies, right.
From New Mexico. So, you know, like, you know, I'm off to Ethiopia this week, and the Jews of Ethiopia left ancient Israel either with the Queen of Sheba, and after she had her son Menelik, who was from King Solomon, they either left with them or after the destruction of the first temple. So they were separated. They didn't know about Hanukkah until a lot of them came to Israel or came to the United States, of the Falashas, the Ethiopian Jews. And they didn't know about Purim, which was another later holiday after the diaspora and first diaspora, and also after the Bible was written. So they got the Bible. They were able to live by the Bible, but they weren't able to live by certain traditions that everybody else
that had followed.
Yeah, and then of course they became. This is what I'm learning, and I'll probably learn a lot more when I get there. In Ethiopia, there are 200 fast days for the Christians, because most of the Jews became Christian early on. And those fast days, the Jews have lots of fast days too, so that, you know, they interconnect.
I can't wait to hear more. It's interesting to me that kosher restrictions don't apply to any fruits or vegetables. Another thing I found out.
No, right. Which is maybe that's easy.
Right. And it maybe it just points out in some way that Jewish cooking is kind of ahead of the curve when it comes to plant-based.
I never thought about that. Knows? It's true.
But it's interesting to me.
And a lot of farmers are very biblical in the way that they look at the land, and it just it's really goes right back to the Bible.
I'd love to talk to you. You've done so much here in D.C., and it's really, I love thinking back, because you were one of the first people to kind of bring me into the city, and you invited me to come down and cook for Sips and Suppers, and I've been doing that pretty much every year. I don't think I did it last year.
You were opening a restaurant.
I was opening a restaurant.
You're allowed.
And this year, we're excited because I think we're going to host a dinner here. We also missed that terrible year with the blizzard, which though it was, I know, I don't want to bring that up. It was a tough one. But your involvement with Sips and Suppers is you've been one of three chair people, right?
Right.
With Jose Andres and Alice Waters for all these years. And now it's time to...
Well, you know, I felt as if we've done it for 10 years, and they both said that they would stop when I stopped. And I felt that I have grandchildren this year, and it's time for the next generation to do it. So the two organizations, we were very successful in what we did. The Sips and Suppers was for DC Central Kitchen, Martha's Table. And
we raised
about $700,000 each year.
Right.
So we've raised, a lot of money in 10 years. And we wanted to continue it. But what they've done is the original way that we did it was having 12 dinners. And now they're going to have about 37 dinners, but in different venues. We're not going to do a big event at the museum, which didn't make any money.
Right.
And we're not, I don't, I might still do my brunch if you convince me to do it. And I don't think Jose is going to do something Friday night, but we're basically making it just like these dinners.
The suppers part, yeah.
Just the suppers part. And hopefully we'll make a lot of money. And, you know, and so that the staff from DC Central Kitchen and Martha's Table are taking it on themselves. And I'm acting as an advisor to them. Well, and I'll be able to see my grandchildren.
And it's great work that you've done and continue to do. And I'm so grateful to have you as a friend. So grateful that you would come and spend some time with us here at Origins. And I highly recommend this cookbook, King Solomon's Table, to anyone. And even more, I would recommend go back and look at Joan's old series on YouTube. It's just, it's fascinating.
Good.
Thanks, Joan Nathan.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org.